From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And we'll start this hour with a tragedy in Arizona, a flash flood that took the lives of at least 9 people, 3 adults, 6 children, 1 adult remains missing. The group had been relaxing at the Cold Spring swimming hole on Saturday, about 100 miles from Phoenix, when a heavy thunderstorm upstream created 6-foot-high floodwaters. Here's Sergeant Detective David Horning with the Gila County Sheriff's Office speaking last night.
Recovering children is probably one of the hardest things to do. You don't see a lot of the emotion come out of us here. It's later that we have our moments.
For more, we're joined by Stina Sieg of Here and Now contributor KJZZ. Stina, first of all, tell us about these victims. It sounds like they were all part of a family group.
Yeah, they were. And we don't know exactly how they were all, you know, related, but they were all on a family outing. The sheriff's office says some of them were from around here, perhaps up in Flagstaff, and some of them were from the Phoenix area.
But some people there were able to be rescued. Tell us about what happened.
Yeah, so 4 people were taken from the floodwaters. They were also from that family group. They were, because a total of 14 people were swept away by the water. And at the time, there happened to be a search and rescue crew, like just in the area, helping a hiker who was having an allergic reaction. So they were able to spring into action immediately and, call for a helicopter. And the sheriff's office says that probably shaved off about 45 minutes and might have saved those 4 people's lives.
What happened here? Is it just as simple as, big thunderstorm and then the water goes downstream and there we are? Or, we know there have been a lot of forest fires in the area recently. Is that related?
I think it is. I mean, the water hit the fire scar left by a recent fire that was just a couple weeks ago. And so all that, all that burned up, debris and brush and logs came rushing down, through this waterway that's usually just a stream. And instead it was, 6 feet high, it was 40 feet wide, and it just, hit the swimming hole, completely unexpectedly.
So there was no warning for anybody?
No, there wasn't. And the thing is, the rain had happened hours before, it had happened miles upstream, and It was not raining at the time that the flood, hit the watering hole and hit the swimming hole. And there had been actually some flash flood warnings that had been issued. But, we're in this really rural area and cell phones don't, for the most part, work there. So there were probably 100 people at the swimming hole at the time. And it's likely that no one even knew that there was a flash flood warning.
How common are situations like this in Arizona?
Well, I mean, flash flooding is really common. We have this wildfire season, which is then, right after there's the monsoon season. And so we have flash floods all the time. But when I was talking to this officer with the sheriff's department, he said that, this kind of tragedy really is not common. Like, he had never seen this scale of life taken in the 13 years he'd been with the sheriff's office.
That's Stina Sieg, who's a senior field correspondent for KJZZ in Arizona, talking with us about the tragic flash flood at a swimming hole there that has taken the lives of at least 9 people. Stina, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, America's shale boom and the fracking of that shale to release natural gas is helping create a growing network of natural gas pipelines. With the accompanying protests from local landowners and environmentalists, we've covered a number of demonstrations across the country. But a lot of their anger is directed at the federal agency charged with approving these interstate pipelines, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC. And now, a months-long investigation concludes FERC isn't really set up to address the concerns of pipeline opponents. You might have heard some of this story on Morning Edition. We're going to continue it here with Kristen Lombardi of the Center for Public Integrity. She joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Hi, Kristen.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined by Marie Cusick of State Impact Pennsylvania. She's at WITF in Harrisburg, PA. Hi, Marie.
Hi, great to be here.
And start with this agency, FERC, charged with making sure new gas pipelines are in the public interest. But opponents say it's just a rubber stamp for the energy industry. Kristen, you start. You look back over decades of the agency's decisions. What did you find?
Well, let me just step back and explain. The primary reason we began digging into FERC and its record on new gas pipelines is this building boom that's happening today. And when we looked at FERC's pipeline data, we were actually pretty surprised by what we find. We found that in 2015, the number of new major pipeline proposals coming before FERC really soared. There were 11 in all just in 1 year, each meant to move gas from the Appalachian Basin states of Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Ohio, up and down the East Coast and across the Midwest, and together they would double the amount of gas that's flowing from this region. Already, FERC has approved 5 of these pipelines. It's on a path to approve the rest, and we wanted to see how typical this is, this near-perfect approval rate. So we examined pipeline cases on file in FERC's electronic library, and we found the agency has only rejected proposed pipelines twice in the past 30 years. That's out of hundreds of projects. On occasion, it has delayed or rescinded approval of projects that don't meet specific conditions, but almost always it does whatever the pipeline companies want. And a lot of this favoritism we found has to do with FERC's very cozy ties to the gas industry. For instance, we looked at where former FERC commissioners go after they leave the agency, and they almost always go to work for energy companies or their law firms or trade groups. 80% of former FERC commissioners went straight to energy companies.
Well, hold on. Marie Cusick, I can hear some people saying, but this is great. Natural gas, so much better than the dirtier oil. What does FERC say about its decisions?
Well, actually, FERC declined our repeated interview requests. They basically said we're a quasi-judicial agency, so we have to be really careful about what we say. We sent them a list of written questions, and they didn't answer a lot of them. They basically said, go read our 20-year-old policy statement. But we talked to a lot of former staffers and commissioners, as many as we could, and all of them basically say, hey, it's not fair to point to that low denial rate, as Kristen mentioned, only 2 pipelines in 30 years. They basically said there's so much time, effort, and money that goes into pipeline planning. These are multi-billion-dollar projects that it can take years. So bad projects are inevitably weeded out throughout the whole process. And, you know, basically, though, if a company does what it's supposed to do, if it dots all its I's and crosses all its T's, then generally the commission will approve it. And they say they like to defer to market forces. So they feel like if it's not needed, you know, it won't be built. And they also said the protesters, people who don't like gas, you know, they're at the wrong building. If you don't like gas production, you should go to your state capitol, your state house, because those people regulate gas production.
Well, remind us why people don't like it. It's a flashpoint over climate change, how new pipelines might impact greenhouse gas emissions. You're saying the agency doesn't take that into account?
Not fully, no. I mean, only until very recently did FERC begin to evaluate greenhouse gas emissions from new pipelines. It works on the assumption that these new pipelines are feeding new gas plants, and those new gas plants are replacing old coal plants, and that has a climate benefit. And natural gas does burn cleaner than coal. It gives off half the planet heating carbon dioxide and a fraction of the toxic air emissions. But gas also consists primarily of methane, which is another potent greenhouse gas, and methane leaks throughout the gas supply chain, wells, processing facilities, pipelines, and compressor stations. And environmentalists have been pushing FERC since as far back as 2013 to conduct deeper analyses of greenhouse gas emissions. They worry these new pipelines are going to lock in this infrastructure that's going to keep the country burning yet another fossil fuel for decades. The Obama administration tried very hard to get FERC to consider greenhouse gas emissions released across the system, from the wellhead to the pipeline to the power plant. Obama's EPA argued that FERC has a duty to evaluate a pipeline proposal's climate impacts under federal law. But former FERC commissioners have told us, you know, we don't have this authority. We regulate the pipeline. And they look at this system, this supply chain, very narrowly. And they've said, you know, if you're unhappy, you should ask Congress to broaden our authority.
Well, meanwhile, President Trump says this is a key part of the country's new energy dominance in the global market. But we understand that we're approaching a natural gas glut, the U.S. producing more than it needs. Does FERC consider this?
Yeah, so basically by next year, we're expected to produce more gas than we consume. It's not really a key consideration for FERC. It can be good for the United States from a geopolitical standpoint, but it's a really hard case to make when someone's backyard is getting torn up through eminent domain for a pipeline, that this stuff really isn't going to be used domestically, and it's going to be shipped to other countries. So the U.S. is using a lot more natural gas and electric power generation, which, as Kristen mentioned, it's a cleaner burning fossil fuel. But again, this whole question of geopolitics, it's really a trade-off. You have to think about people's private property.
Marie Cusick with State Impact Pennsylvania, Kristen Lombardi with the Center for Public Integrity. For more are on their months-long investigation into the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC. Go to hearandnow.org. Marie, Kristen, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you.
What's the biggest religion in the world? Well, right now, it's Christianity. But in the next 50 years, it is projected to be Islam. As the world's population grows 32% over that period, the number of Muslims is expected to grow by 70%, from 1.8 billion to almost 3 billion in 2060. Joining us now is Conrad Hackett, who's Associate Director of Research and Senior Demographer at Pew Research Center. Conrad Hackett, why is Islam growing as fast as it is?
Muslims are the youngest major religious group in the world. They have a median age of 24. And Muslims have more children than people in any other group, about 3 children per woman who's Muslim, compared to about 2.2 children per woman who's not Muslim in the world.
So it's just birth rate, basically. It's that people in the Muslim faith are just having more kids, and those kids grow up and they're Muslim as well.
Yes. People, of course, do change religious faiths, and we've measured religious switching. But for Muslims, the story, as far as we can tell, is really about natural increase. A lot more Muslims being born than are dying in any given year.
Do we know why?
Well, the Muslim population has been young for some time. It's growing in Africa and other countries that have rapidly growing populations. In fact, we project that by the year 2035, there'll be more babies born to Muslim women than to Christian women or women in any other faith. And by 2075, that there'll be more Muslims in the world than people in any other religious group, including Christianity.
And right now, by the way, Christians still have more children than Muslims, right?
Yes, that's correct.
What about other religions? How do they factor in?
Christians and Muslims are the only groups that are growing faster than the world's population overall. So most religious groups are growing in number, but they're not keeping pace with the world's population growth. And in fact, the world's Buddhist population is actually growing a little bit slower. So we project that over the next few decades, the number of Buddhists in the world is actually going to decrease.
You mentioned people changing religions. What are we seeing there about people either converting to Islam or leaving the faith?
Well, we've studied a couple dozen Muslim-majority countries, and we don't see much change in religious identity in those countries. In Egypt, for example, most people who grew up Christian retain that identity as adults, and the same for those who grew up Muslim. There are some restrictions on switching faith in Muslim-majority countries. You might be stigmatized or face legal consequences for apostasy for changing faith. So that's a factor that may limit what we can capture. But the big change in terms of religious switching in the world is from people who grew up Christian to those who now identify with no religion. And that population of people who claim no religion is growing a lot through religious switching, not through fertility. Those folks tend to have fewer children than people who have a religious affiliation.
Did you learn anything about how religious the children of Muslims stay as they grow up?
In this study, we didn't actually measure religious devotion. We just measured the way that people identify when they're asked in a census or survey, what is your religion? So we don't have a direct measure of that.
What does all this mean for the global population, do you think?
Well, one way of thinking about it is we have this rapidly secularizing West, places like the United States and Europe, more people are becoming unaffiliated. And then we have this population of the rapidly growing rest of the world, places like Africa, where almost everyone continues to identify with the religion, and the number of people there is multiplying greatly. By 2060, 4 out of 10 of the world's Christians will live in sub-Saharan Africa, according to our projections, for example. There's a big geographic shift underway in terms of where the world's Christians live, and the population of people who are religious increasingly are living outside of Europe, North America. 100 years ago, 2 out of 3 Christians lived in Europe, and that's no longer the case.
What about here in North America? Are you seeing an expansion of the number of Muslims?
The Muslim population is growing in the United States. We project that by the year 2050, there'll be more Muslims than Christians or Hindus or Buddhists in the U.S. Hmm. Currently, about 1% of the U.S. population is Muslim, and that's going to increase by a couple of percentage points in the decades to come, and that's growing because Muslims in the U.S., like Muslims worldwide, are younger than other major religious groups and having more children, and also have been growing through immigration, and we expect are likely to continue to do so.
That's Conrad Hackett, who is Associate Director of Research and Senior Demographer at Pew Research Center. Conrad, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, even as Islam grows, some are leaving the faith, including Imtiaz Shams, who was raised as a Muslim but left the faith and founded Faith to Faithless, which helps people doubting and leaving their religions find support. He joins us from London. Imtiaz Shams, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
And what led you to start doubting and then ultimately leave Islam?
I mean, in my case, I was raised very religiously, not just from family, but just myself. It was something that was very important to how I lived my life. And as you live your life in a certain faith background, you always have questions. Everyone has questions. There's no doubt about that, right? What happened, though, is the answers I had for some of these questions, they became less meaningful to me. So as I sort of developed my critical thinking, as I met other people beyond my faith community, it started really hitting me that something wasn't right. And that's not when there was like a light bulb moment. The light bulb moment took, you know, I would say somewhere between 6 months to a year. But there was sort of a slow progression where something doesn't feel right. And I started really researching my faith again, but with an open mind. And, well, and it didn't make any sense for me anymore.
What kind of questions were you asking?
So, you know, from when I was a young boy, I'd been reading books on Islam. I had questions even back then. You know, growing up, I had questions around some of the morality within the faith in terms of, you know, some of the political things that were done to non-Muslims, things around women's roles in Islam and sort of things like Aisha, one of the wives of the Prophet, who was quite young when she was married. As I got older, some of these questions that I had thought I had answered stopped making sense as I learned more about the world and critical thinking developed and things like that.
And did you join another religion?
Not at all. That was almost unfeasible for me. Why would I, you know, for me, other religions seem to have the same problems as Islam. So I kind of floated around as quite, as like an agnostic for a while.
What was it like for you to tell your family and your Muslim friends that you were leaving the faith?
Yeah, so I'll talk about my Muslim friends first. I sort of, quote-unquote, came out on Facebook as a non-Muslim after a couple of years of working behind the scenes to help people like myself. And when I did that, there was mixed responses. So some Muslims, whether they were religious or not, actually didn't make a huge difference. Some Muslims just could not fathom that someone would leave Islam, and I got a lot of abusive messages and things like that. There were a few Muslims that either privately or publicly supported me. And that made all the difference. They're the ones that I still call my friends today, and they made all the difference to me.
And why do you think they did that?
You know, I think if you look at all of them, a lot of them have been through their own journeys. Some of them were women who went through their own difficulties taking the hijab off and still being a Muslim. Some of them had friends who came out as gay but Muslim. And some of them just were aware of me. They knew who I was, and they knew that I hadn't become some sort of evil, you know, psychopath because I'd left religion. They realized that I was still the same person that I was when they knew me when I was younger.
And what about your family?
My family had it difficult in the beginning. You know, you can imagine that something that's that fundamental to them. I was the religious kid in my family in many ways. However, what's been amazing is how over time they've started to really accept me. You know, we've kind of gotten past the fact that I'm this other, and I am back again, I would say, a member of the family. And that gives me so much hope, because it's not just me. I'm seeing lots and lots of kids who leave Islam, who are ex-Muslims, telling their family. And it ranges from families going, you know what, I just accept you, doesn't matter, to it being very uncomfortable, but they don't kick them out. I know that's a big thing to say, that, you know, oh, you're not kicking anyone out. But it's a big thing, because only a few years back, that's pretty much what would happen.
The interesting thing, though, is you say you've got a lot of people that you've talked to who have done the same thing. When you look at the overall numbers, though, there are very few Muslims leaving that faith.
That's not true at all. That's to do with stigma. Just like you could say the same thing about Jehovah's Witnesses leaving, right? You could look at the numbers and say Jehovah's Witnesses do not leave their faith. But actually, in a big way, they are leaving, except because of shunning doctrines, they don't come out. In the same way, so for example, you know, I know people who are 50 years old who are ex-Muslims who've left faith, right? Why are they not out? Because if they tell their families, they will lose their whole families, right? So of course they're not going to tell people. Of course they're not going to stand up and be counted. And that's what we're trying to change. We're trying to make it so that we can be counted, so that people don't think we don't exist. And there's many, many of us. I mean, Saudi Arabia, believe it or not, has so many people who leave Islam you wouldn't even believe. I work with a lot of them, and there's just an insane amount coming out of Saudi Arabia who don't believe in their faith anymore.
But you're saying that even if they leave the faith, they might not tell anyone.
Absolutely. So you just don't, quote-unquote, come out. What's been amazing is the internet groups, though. The internet groups have been allowing people to stand up and be counted without being public about it.
That's Imtiaz Shams, who has left the Muslim faith and now helps others who are doubting or who have stopped practicing their religions find support. He's part of an organization called Faith to Faithless. Imtiaz, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much, Jeremy.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
There will be no Senate vote on the health care bill this week. It has been delayed indefinitely while Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona is out recovering from surgery. Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn told NBC's Meet the Press yesterday that they will pick up the vote when McCain returns.
I believe as soon as we have a full contingent of senators that will have that vote, it's important we do so.
With or without McCain, though, some senators are not convinced the votes are there to pass the health care overhaul. Joining us now is Julie Robner, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Hi, Julie.
Hey, Jeremy.
And first of all, how long might the delay on a vote be? Do we know?
We really don't. What we heard Saturday night when the news first broke about Senator McCain's surgery is that he would probably be back next week. But the rumor around Washington today is that it might not be so soon. That would start to run into problems. The next thing the Senate is supposed to do is the big defense authorization bill. But they can't do that without McCain either, because he's the chairman of the committee.
Right. So what about the current version of the health care bill? It sounds like it's still being tweaked a bit to win over senators.
Yeah, there's some question about whether this is good. This delay is good for Senator McConnell trying to put together the votes, or bad for Senator McConnell because it gives opponents more time to mobilize to try to fight the bill. What we do know is that there are two senators who are already on record as opposing this, and the next one would basically block the bill from even coming up for debate.
One of the senators that you're talking about is Susan Collins, the Republican from Maine. Here she is speaking yesterday on ABC's This Week.
On the Senate side, I would estimate that there are about 8 to 10 Republican senators who have deep concerns. But how this would all translate out, I'm not certain. And I never underestimate Leader McConnell's skills.
Julia, it's kind of hard to tell whether this bill has just two senators opposed to it on the Republican side or a lot of senators opposed to it. Do you know more than we do about what's going on?
Well, we certainly know that there were a number of senators who were opposed to it in its first form, the form from a couple of weeks ago, and that they've pretty much said that they are not very impressed with the changes that Senator McConnell made. They were mostly saying they wanted to wait for the Congressional Budget Office report, which we originally thought would be out today. Now there's talk it might be out tomorrow. I would guess that it wouldn't be out until shortly before they want to go to the floor, so it might not come out this week at all. But I think the idea is that of those senators who are opposed, nobody wants to be the third. No one wants to be the vote that kills this. But a lot of people are expecting to see a group of them maybe come out together, and so they could be the third, fourth, fifth, and sixth votes against it.
Well, what are you watching for in this next CBO score when it comes out?
Well, I'm watching for, obviously, the number of uninsured, whether that goes up or down. I'm particularly watching for what they think of this amendment offered by Senator Cruz, which would allow, you know, less comprehensive insurance policies to be sold. The insurance industry says that that is unworkable. We don't know how long it might take CBO, though, to actually score that. There's some question about whether they would be able to. It could take them weeks.
Just briefly, in the time we have left, it sounds like a lot of the governors that were at the annual summer meeting of the nation's governors came out pretty strongly against this. Did that make a difference?
I think it might. You know, the administration sent a number of people, including Vice President Pence, to the governor's meeting. But from the Republicans whose states expanded Medicaid and who are still worried about this bill, they still seem to be worried.
That's Julie Robner, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Julie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now, a great story. After President Trump fired FBI Director James Comey in May and Robert Mueller was appointed special counsel on the Russia investigation, the president raised questions about whether Mueller could be impartial.
Well, he's very, very good friends with Comey, which is very bothersome. But he's also, we're going to have to see.
Right-wing Breitbart News picked that up. Their story cited a former assistant FBI director, James Kallstrom, saying Comey and Mueller were BFFs, that it's a massive conflict of interest. And Breitbart also cited Garrett Graff, who wrote a political article titled What Donald Trump Needs to Know About Bob Mueller and Jim Comey. But Garrett says they got what he thinks wrong. Garrett Graff is also author of The Threat Matrix, Inside Robert Mueller's FBI. He joins us for a look at this relationship. And Garrett, Snopes.com, the myth-busting website, says the claim that these two men are best friends is mostly false. What do you say?
They're not best friends in a social sense. These are two people who have worked incredibly closely together. You know, there were probably periods of time where they were spending more time with each other than they were with their wives in those years right after 9/11.
But also, they were both involved in one of the most incredible stories. Some people may not remember it or be familiar with it. So we want to go back to this interaction between the two men that you couldn't make up. This is 2004 during the George W. Bush administration. John Ashcroft was Attorney General. James Comey was his assistant. Bob Mueller was then head of the FBI. Now, the Bush White House was trying to reauthorize a controversial NSA eavesdropping program. And so first tell us, how did John Ashcroft and James Comey feel about that reauthorization?
So James Comey had come to understand that this NSA domestic surveillance program, known by its codename Stellar Wind, was on shaky constitutional ground. And really, as he got into it, as other Justice Department officials got into it, they really came to believe that it was unconstitutional and needed to be wound down. Mm-hmm. And this put them on a collision course with the Bush White House, and particularly with then Vice President Cheney and his office.
But James Comey knows for sure that his boss, John Ashcroft, does not want to reauthorize this program. Okay, suddenly, Ashcroft is taken severely ill. He's hospitalized. Comey becomes acting attorney general, and he's driving along in his car when what happens?
He's heading home and gets a telephone call from John Ashcroft's hospital room saying that then White House Chief of Staff Andy Card and White House Counsel Alberto Gonzalez are on their way to Ashcroft's bedside to try to get Ashcroft to legally sign to reauthorize this Stellar Wind program.
It was actually Mrs. Ashcroft, right, who said, call James Comey.
Yep. So Jim Comey turns on the lights and siren in his car. He's being driven by a U.S. Marshal at the time. And his first telephone call is to Bob Mueller, the FBI director.
So hold up the story there, because Comey himself got to tell this story in very dramatic Senate testimony about it several years later. He said, first of all, he called his chief of staff, told him to get other senior staff to the hospital as quickly as possible, because the thinking was Ashcroft was so sick, this was severe gallstone pancreatitis, that he was probably under the effects of drugs, and who knows what might happen when the Bush officials got to his hospital room. So Comey first calls his chief of staff, and then he relates this.
I hung up, called Director Mueller, with whom I'd been discussing this particular matter, and who'd been a great help to me over that week, and told him what was happening. He said, I'll meet you at the hospital right now. Told my security detail that I need to get to George Washington Hospital immediately. They turned on the emergency equipment and drove very quickly to the hospital.
Hey, Garrett, what a scene. You've got these two different people, Mueller, the then FBI director, and Comey, the deputy attorney general, sirens wailing, you know, making their way to the hospital. But people have remarked on this. Why did he call Robert Mueller?
So when I was working on my biography of Bob Mueller, I had someone tell me that if I could figure out why Bob Mueller was in that room, why he was in that telephone call, it would unlock the secret to Bob Mueller, because there was no particular reason why the FBI director should be involved in the Justice Department's conversation with the White House about an NSA program. And I actually had the opportunity in the summer of 2008 to put that question directly to Jim Comey. And I asked him, you know, why did you call Bob Mueller? And he said Bob Mueller was a figure who was beyond reproach, that he knew that he, Jim Comey, could be seen as a political person at the Justice Department, and that he knew that even if he threatened to resign, there was no way that any president would let their FBI director resign over a matter of constitutionality like this.
Well, so picking up the story, after rushing to the hospital, James Comey says he ran up the stairs, you know, two at a time, to Ashcroft's room in the intensive care unit, found him to be very ill, somewhat disoriented. He tried talking to Ashcroft, and when he couldn't, once again, he turned to Mueller. Let's listen.
I went out in the hallway, spoke to Director Mueller by phone. He was on his way. I handed the phone to the head of the security detail, and Director Mueller instructed the FBI agents present not to allow me to be removed from the room under any circumstances.
This is extraordinary. You have the acting attorney general asking the director of the FBI to physically protect him.
To physically protect him from the U.S. Secret Service. That was the most bizarre moment of this. Andy Card and Alberto Gonzalez, when they arrived, they were going to have Secret Service protection.
And Andy Card was the White House chief of staff, and Alberto Gonzalez was White House counsel.
Yes. And Jim Comey was afraid that those Secret Service agents would remove him from the hospital room and allow Andy Card and Alberto Gonzalez to speak privately with Attorney General Ashcroft. And so that telephone call, I mean, that has to be one of the most surreal moments in modern U.S. government history, where you have the FBI director instructing these FBI agents who until that moment, you know, 7 p.m. on a weeknight in an empty hospital wing at George Washington Hospital, these agents probably thought they were on the quietest assignment they could ever have in their lives. And they get a telephone call from the FBI director saying that they should use force if necessary to resist the U.S. Secret Service at the orders of the White House Chief of Staff from removing the Deputy Attorney General from the room.
Amazing.
I mean, just an incredibly surreal moment.
Okay. So Mueller gets everybody to stand down. Card and Gonzalez are in the hospital room, and Gonzalez is asking this very ill John Ashcroft to reauthorize this controversial eavesdropping program. And here's what Comey says happened next.
Attorney General Ashcroft then stunned me. He lifted his head off the pillow and in very strong terms expressed his view of the matter, rich in both substance and fact, and then laid his head back down on the pillow, seemed spent, and said to them, but that doesn't matter because I'm not the Attorney General. There is the Attorney General, and he pointed to me when I was just to his left. The two men did not acknowledge me. They turned and walked from the room.
So Comey seemed to win that round in the hospital room. But the next day, the White House, the George W. Bush White House, told him they were reauthorizing the program without the approval of the Justice Department. How did Comey and Mueller react?
So Jim Comey met privately with President Bush and said that he was prepared to resign. And you should know that Bob Mueller is prepared to resign as well. And according to the version that we have heard, Bush's eyes go wide, and he immediately summons Bob Mueller. And then at the conclusion of his conversation with Bob Mueller, effectively says, let Jim make the changes to the program that he needs to make in order to make it legal. Mm. President Bush blinked, the White House blinked, and Jim Comey and Bob Mueller won the fight.
So they have been burnished, and that's the time we know of. You know, there may be others. Do you think, though, that Bob Mueller will be able to put that aside and do the work he needs to do on the Russia investigation? In other words, do you think that that experience is a conflict of interest?
I actually think that Bob Mueller might be the only person in America who could do this job. He exists on this incredibly short list of figures in Washington who are seen as entirely above politics and is going to turn in a report that is so thorough that it will remove any doubt that there could be any real bias.
Garrett Graff. Garrett, thank you.
My pleasure.
Lawmakers in Connecticut are again delaying a vote on a budget deal as the state struggles with a fiscal crisis and an estimated $2 billion budget gap. Connecticut has also faced other bad news in recent months. This spring, the insurance giant Aetna announced it will move its headquarters out of the state after a similar announcement from General Electric last year. And the Atlantic senior editor Derek Thompson writes that what's happening in Connecticut mirrors big changes in the country as a whole. Derek is with us from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
So first of all, make your case about that. What does the situation in Connecticut tell us about the U.S. overall?
Think about the most important ideas in America and U.S. economics right now. Huge income inequality, mysterious slow growth, the role of finance, the growth of low-wage service sector jobs, the balancing act of investing in education while taking care of the poor and sick, while tending to the budget, the life and death of American cities. Connecticut doesn't just have one or two of these storylines. It has every single storyline on steroids. It is a greatest hits compilation of American economic stories, and that is what fascinated me about the state's current situation.
Well, and you write that a lot of Connecticut's woes have to do with the downfall of manufacturing there. What happened in Connecticut?
Well, it's interesting because the story of Connecticut's industrial mix, the industries that are most important to its growth, mirrors the United States as well. It was a manufacturing hub in the 1950s, and then it became a finance-heavy state in the 1980s, 1990s. But right now, what's interesting is that you're seeing both manufacturing and finance jobs go away, and Connecticut is trying to rediscover its identity for this decade and next. It is no longer a manufacturing state. It is no longer a growing finance state. In terms of jobs, what happens next? That is one of the most important questions for the state to answer.
And Connecticut, by the way, interesting fact, is the richest state in the country by per capita income. It's actually behind D.C., which, as we know, is not a state. But you point out that Connecticut is now adding more low-wage jobs than high-wage jobs.
That's right. If you look at a graph of the jobs that Connecticut is losing the fastest and gaining the fastest, what is it losing the fastest? Guess what? It's manufacturing and finance. It's the two industries that defined its identity in the second half of the 20th century. What's growing the fastest? It's low-wage healthcare jobs. It's low-wage leisure and hospitality jobs. And what you have is really fascinating. You do have an incredibly rich state when it comes to average incomes, and therefore you tend to have high costs. But you have a high-cost state in which the fastest-growing jobs are all paid at low wages. And as a result, it's not a very attractive place to live for families that are on the move. And so, indeed, you might expect that a state like this its growth might stop and even start to go in reverse. And that's exactly what's happening. Connecticut's population has been shrinking for the last 3 years.
Now, let's talk about the politics here a little bit, because you point out that both liberals and conservatives look to Connecticut as an example of different trends. What do the liberals see in the state?
Right. I call it the Rorschach state, because for the left and for the right, it's a manifestation of each side's greatest fears. I think what liberals see in the state is the apotheosis of their greatest fears of income inequality. What's going to happen to the nation writ large if income inequality gets too crazy? Well, you could see, you know, the rich clustering in one area while poverty increases in another, and there won't be enough money shared between the two of them. And indeed, that is exactly what you're seeing. Some of the richest places in America, richest places in the world, are along the Gold Coast and in South Connecticut, while nearby cities are actually seeing rising poverty rates. This is exactly what I think a lot of liberals fear when they see the rich racing away from the rest.
And what about conservatives? What do they see in Connecticut?
Conservatives are saying this is a tax story. Look at what's happening to its pensions, to its deficit. Connecticut has raised taxes to a level, an altitude that cannot support economic life. And that is why the state is struggling. And it's interesting because, you know, I think both sides do have a bit of a case. Taxes are high in Connecticut and families do consider taxes and cost of living when they're moving around the country. But at the same time, I think the liberals are right as well, and particularly liberal urban thinkers who are essentially saying Connecticut hasn't paid enough attention to building and designing great American cities where young middle-class people want to move to.
So we brought up this issue last month on the show, and we heard from Connecticut's Speaker of the House, Joe Arasimowitz, who said the recent corporate departures show a failure in, as you're talking about, the state's cities.
Our inactivity, our unwillingness to come up with an overall goal for our urban centers in the state of Connecticut is yet again costing us dearly. It costs us repeatedly with the achievement gap. It costs us dearly now in economic development.
So, Derek, just in the few seconds we have left, what does Connecticut need to do to fix the problem?
Two quick points. Where America is moving right now is south, west, and cheap. Connecticut is north, east, and expensive. It is on the opposite end of the national migration trends. Second, I think that Joe Arasimowitz was exactly correct in what he said. I think that Connecticut has to focus on building great urban centers where young middle-class people want to move to.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thank you.
Thank you.
And this note today on All Things Considered, we'll hear from voters in rural England who supported Brexit and some doubt that politicians are ever going to carry out the will of the voters. That's later on All Things Considered. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.